IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is IRIB English Radio's Viewpoints. I am Hadi Saravi, your host. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Viewpoints. I am Hadi Saravi, your host. Qadr and its nights are among the important times of the year on Muslim calendar. Although the literature around these nights are rich and a lot has been said and written, these nights are still mysterious and many aspects and values of it are still truly unknown to Muslims across the globe. On this episode, we try to shed yet another light on it. I would like to start our team of experts here in the studio. On my left, dear brother Ali, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum and thanks for inviting me to your show.
It's great to have you here. And also Dr. Rouhani is a very esteemed guest and this is great to have him again here. Welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome. Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yeah,
thank you for being here. So let's start with a question, a very important one. Let's talk about the meanings behind these nights and also, you know, there are different meanings behind it. Some people say that these nights are the nights of destiny and also and words like that and many other thoughts have been arisen. So let's start from Dr. Rouhani, your thoughts on the meanings and philosophy of these nights.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, Laylatul Qadr or Night of Qadr. Qadr means measure or destiny. This night, which is a specific night in the holy month of Ramadan, is named and termed as Laylatul Qadr by the Holy Quran. Of course, it is the night of the revelation of the Quran, and it is the night of predestination of the coming years, of affairs of the coming year for everyone. That's why it's called also Night of Destiny or Night of Predestination, we can say. In the Quran and the Ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam, Laylatul Qadr or Night of Qadr is said to be one of the very significant and valuable and precious time and night in which the ibadah and worship is like 1,000 months. It values 1,000 months. In this holy night and its virtues and its importance, its value is so much high that is not comparable to any other kind of night in any other time. So that's why in this night the sins will be forgiven inshallah ta'ala by Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in this night the angels descend on the earth, تَنَزَّلُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ وَالرُّوحُ فِيهَا بِإِذْنِ رَبِّهِمْ. It refers to the descendants of the angels on the earth. From the Shiite perspective, it's a very important question that so the angels descend on the earth, on whom they descend, to whom they talk, to whom they refer. According to the Shiite teachings and doctrines and Ahlul Bayt school of teaching and doctrines, these angels will come to the Imam and revealed or let's say decide about the affairs of the new year of the followers of Islam and the other people in this night, which is called a night of Qadr. But regarding the exact timing of this night, that on what exact night this night is, of course, there's a consensus among all Muslims, Muslim scholars, that it is in the holy month of Ramadan. But according to the Shiite ahadith and let's say doctrines, it is highly possible to be in the 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan. But most of the majority of the Sunni or Sunnite scholars, they are of the view that it will be on the 27th of the holy month of Ramadan. But of course, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam, based on the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt, they actually celebrate all the 19th and 21st and 23rd of the holy month of Ramadan as the night of Qadr.
Okay, so very well said, thank you. And the timing, the timings of it are under question, but they said, I mean, it's chosen, you know, somehow between three nights. And you talked about the timing. Is it important, you know, we can celebrate, I mean, we can appreciate these nights. Why 3 days? And is it hidden somehow?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his immaculate progeny. Well, maybe the philosophy behind not having or not disclosing the exact date of this holy night is due to its preciousness. I mean, when we have a treasury, we try to hide it in different, let's say, safes to keep it safe.
Now, you safeguard it.
Yeah, we safeguard it in order to show the importance of it. Even a piece of diamond is usually kept where? In I mean, in the street? No. It is usually kept in the most important safes. So we want to say that by this, the Muslims are, for example, are encouraged to value all these three nights to at least, if it is going to be at the third night, to prepare themselves for the entrance in the third night, right? Mm. If it is in the first night, at least they need to actually control themselves and have those recommendations and try to keep up with those recommendations or mustahabbat and whatever has been said in the books of Dua and supplication and even scientific discussions, which has been actually recommended a lot in these nights, because it shows even the rationality of our religion, that even in the most important night of the year, wants us to search for knowledge. I mean, to be in search of knowledge and science. You see, it shows the importance of science and how this religion actually pays attention to gaining knowledge and even these important nights. Though on the dating event, there is another version of the night of 27th for some of the Islamic denominations, but majority of but some Muslims usually actually try to keep up with these three nights: the nights of 19th, 21st, and 23rd. But it's good to, as I said earlier, it's good to value and appreciate all these three nights, and even in case for those who are interested, because we have in the hadith that the Holy Prophet even, left the house usually at the last decade of the holy month of Ramadan and started the i'tikaf in the masjid. I mean, the Holy Prophet himself has been valuing and appreciating the last 10 nights, you see? Mm. And
he himself appreciated all these three nights?
Definitely these three nights, due to a hadith that has been narrated from the Holy Prophet, that one a person, an Arabi, came to the Holy Prophet and asked him, since I'm coming from from distant villages, can you tell me which night is the night of Qadr so that I come and attend the programs and I value and appreciate it?
Got it.
Then the Holy Prophet said something in his ears. Then from that year and onward, the people have been saying that this old man is actually valuing and appreciating and attending the programs, for example, in the third night of Laylatul Qadr, that is on the 23rd. So still, we don't want to say that for sure this is the third, the third night of Qadr is the night of Qadr that we are talking about. I mean, that important night. Mm-hmm. But it's better to value all these three consecutive nights, inshallah, to take the benefits of them. Even if they are not going to be, the first two are not going to be the nights of Qadr, at least we have did a good action. I mean, a mustahab action. We recited the Holy Quran. We searched for the knowledge and we were in search of gaining knowledge and science.
Yeah.
So we didn't do any bad thing. So it's good to at least do whatever we can and whatever we are able to do.
And also what you said, it's... these nights, appreciating, staying awake, sometimes reading, studying, thinking about this universe, the values. Also, we can think about some religious concepts are appreciated. And also reading du'as sometimes, reciting Quran sometimes is very valued. I want you to help us understand, Dr. Rouhani, about the importance of these ideas, how to better spend our precious time over these precious nights? You know, how to get the best out of it?
Yes, of course. If we refer to ahadith and riwayat, there are specific recommendations on Laylatul Qadr that we can practice. For example, it is said that so ghusl is one of the rituals of this holy night, and prayer of Laylatul Qadr, which is a specific prayer that can be performed, reciting Surah 44 and Surah 97 of the Holy Quran in this holy night, reciting the supplication of Al-Jawshan Al-Kabir in this holy month is very much recommended. Ziyarah of Abu Abdullah Al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam is very much recommended in this holy night. And holding the Quran on the head and ask forgiveness and make dua in this specific night, they are some of the rituals that can be followed in this holy night. Particular acts for each night are also mentioned in some of the, let's say, dua and supplication sources that people can refer, brothers and sisters can refer and perform those kind of rituals. These are some specific kind of recommendations in this holy month. But of course, there are some, of course, secrets also in this holy month that are also mentioned in the riwayat that we can refer to some of them. For example, when it comes to this point that what are some of the secrets of this holy month, in some of our hadiths it is said that if someone understands the true status and rank of Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, this is one of the secrets of the Laylatul Qadr. This is very much important that are mentioned in riwayat that Lady Fatima salamullahi alayha is referred to as the secret of the night of Qadr in ahadith and riwayat. And also the a'mal, or let's say the rituals performed by this lady, should be followed in this holy month. And also the night of Qadr is a kind of evidence for proving the truthfulness of tashayyu. Tashayyu is school of thought and, let's say, religion, because in this holy night, the night of descendants of the malaik or the angels happen in this night. So the Shiite scholars, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, are of the view that, of course, these angels, when they come to the earth, when they descend to the earth, on the earth, so of course they will share something with the Khalifatullah Ta'ala on the earth. And the question is that this tanazzalul malaikati wa ruhu fiha, tanazzalul malaika means that every year, every night of Qadr, in the Holy Quran it said that every night of Qadr this malaik tanazzal.
It has a continuation.
Yeah, it continuously happens. So then the question is that on whom, on which place, on which house, on which people, the descendant. That's why in our riwayat it is mentioned that they will descend on the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, and nowadays on the Imam al-Asr arwahuna fidah. And then the affairs of the people will be predestined in this holy night.
Thank you. Like our guest mentioned, Qadr and Quran are in a way connected to each other. On these nights, humanity, especially Shia, lost a great man too, one who was a true exemplar of Quran in action. Let's make a promise to ourselves. Let's try to take one step toward reading and thinking about these divine concepts. And by doing so, let these heavenly words revive our body and soul. That's all the time we have. Don't forget to tune in next time. For now, may the mighty Allah bless you all. Stay safe.
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتنا يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارنا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتنا فيك أتى القرآن
من حضرة الرحمن فيك أتى القرآن من حضرة الرحمن للناس بالفرقان يا ليلة القدر
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارينا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتينا
اطلب من الرحمن العفو والغفران اطلب من الرحمن العفو والغفران ما أكثر الإحسان في ليلة القدر
يا ليلة القدر يا فضل بارينا خير من الدهر بالعفو تاتينا
Cancer, the new trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists are now able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details. Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
Le cancer ne sera pas vaincu en un jour.
Today I'm announcing we are directing $30 million of that new budget.
Since then, real progress has been made. We are now able to detect, treat, and prevent cancer much better than in the past. 70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
Cancer is the dangerous overproliferation of certain cells in the body. When everything interacts in a harmonious way, the body grows. That's what happens in children or in fetal development. When cells multiply in what we call a normal way, the process is harmonious and coordinated. But when the cell proliferation does not respect this process and gets out of line, so to speak, that's what we call cancer.
I mean, you have to remember what cancer is. Cancer is a kind of traitorous cell in your own body, and that's one of the things that makes it so diabolical, so difficult to treat. It's your own flesh and blood that has become immortal. The cancer cell is an immortal cell. People don't realize this, but all of our cells are destined to die, and it's actually the death of the cell that's healthy. Our cells regenerate it through death. They're constantly growing. But if a cell stays alive and keeps growing, that is what cancer is.
Where does this paradoxical explosion of life that is cancer come from? How can it be prevented and controlled? Surgery was first used to treat cancer in the 19th century, and then, at the beginning of the 20th century, radiation therapy was developed. Both methods target the tumor, which is a cluster of cancer cells that form in an organ. But these methods do not prevent some of the cells from escaping and spreading to other organs. The resulting secondary tumors, called metastases, are often highly malignant. In order to stop this fatal process, a new weapon was developed in the 1950s. On December 2, 1943, German warplanes bombed the town of Bari in Italy. One of the ships in the harbour exploded. It was carrying 2,000 bombs of mustard gas, a highly toxic poison gas. Over the next few months, more than 1,000 people died, both soldiers as well as civilians. The doctors who treated the victims poisoned by the gas noticed that they had very few white blood cells in their blood. This incident led researchers to come up with a new idea. If mustard gas could kill blood cells, why not use similar toxic chemicals to eliminate cancer cells? That was the beginning of chemotherapy. A few years later, it was being used effectively against previously incurable cancers. However, chemotherapy hits hard and indiscriminately. It kills diseased cells as well as healthy cells. It is a scorched earth strategy applied to the entire organism that is extremely harsh on the body. Its side effects range from nausea to hair loss, to anemia and other immune system disorders. Moreover, while some cancers respond to it, others resist it, for reasons that we are still unable to explain.
The idea of using chemotherapy against cancer was purely pragmatic. We don't know why a particular tumor responds specifically to such and such an agent. However, what we suspected was that chemotherapy acted and could be especially effective on rapidly proliferating cells. That's why pediatric tumors were good targets. But unfortunately, this explanation turns out to be insufficient. So we have made advances, but we do not necessarily understand why we made those advances.
While cancer treatment has progressed significantly, many gray areas remain with regard to the disease itself. In the 1970s, it was thought that the mystery had finally been pierced. Two researchers, Harold Varmus and Michael Bishop, demonstrated for the first time that the enemy might come from within their own cells. It could even be lurking in our genes. For this discovery, they were awarded the Nobel Prize. In order to understand this, we must return to the basic principles of the science of genetics. They postulate that DNA controls everything in our bodies. Cancer occurs when something disrupts the codes that regulate the way everything functions in the body. A gene that is damaged, broken, or undergoes mutation may cause cells to deviate from their genetic programming.
When certain cells start to go out of control, which is the case with cancer, they are no longer following their genetic programming. What happens in this process, which is called mutation, is that the cells change their own DNA. So the DNA is altered, the control mechanism is impaired, and as a result, they escape genetic regulation. That's what is now called the genetic theory, or the mutational theory of cancer, which states that cancer is caused by mutations that occur in cancer cells.
A new era is dawning. Researchers began using new techniques to hunt for oncogenes, those genes whose mutations are the cause of cancer. Robert Weinberg is an iconic figure in the field of cancer genetics. Following in the footsteps of Varmus and Bishop, his work has helped to greatly elucidate the biological factors at work in the development of cancer.
In 1978, we began an experimental procedure that allowed us to demonstrate a year later that, in fact, if one looks into the DNA of cancer cells, one can find their damaged genetic information that is responsible for driving the unconfined, the unconstrained proliferation of human cancer cells. The DNA that we looked at there turned out to be a cancer-causing gene, which is called an oncogene. The oncogene is a damaged form of a gene that resides in normal human DNA, and under the influence of the chemical carcinogen, this gene is mutated. It's altered so that its altered sequence information now creates an oncogene that persuades the cell to grow without limit, without any confinement, and to grow and form thousands, millions, billions of descendants.
Vast amounts of human and financial resources are thus being poured into the area of oncogene research. Billions are being invested in equipment and technology. The human genome is being mapped, and we will soon know everything there is to know, not only about cancer, but about many other diseases as well. The genetic approach now stands out as the one and only path.
I do think that there is by now a commitment to genetics. There is a commitment in our National Institutes of Health. How could there not be? Our director is a geneticist. We have by now an enormous infrastructure of biotech companies built over the last 50 years to work with laboratory scientists to study the genetics of this and the genetics of that.
Today, we have dozens of countries across the world really involved in the race to actually sequence cancer genomes, find cancer genomes. So the science of cancer is really progressed very quickly because we now understand genetics and genomes and we can actually catalog mutations.
Canadian scientist Thomas Hudson runs a large international consortium that is in the process of completing the sequencing of 25,000 tumors.
For our ability to not just discover cancer genes, but rapidly understanding the biology of the cancer genes, at least, and try to make drugs for the most important ones, is actually becoming almost routine.
When I was studying the rise of oncogene research, it was a new bright star, right? It was a hope. People really thought that we were getting to the cause, the basic causes of cancer, and that it would eventually lead to solutions, to treatments.
In the late 1990s, drugs designed to target and affect the behavior of cancer-causing genes were developed. Next to chemotherapy, these so-called targeted treatments appear to be considerably less destructive. Their impact on the body is gentler, with fewer side effects. The pharmaceutical industry has invested massively in these new therapies, which represent more than half of the anti-cancer drugs now being developed. 200 products are already on the market, and 900 are in preparation.
There are a lot of advances happening in oncology today because of targeted therapies. And we know that some, like Gleevec, actually have a long response. But the disappointment is many of the new targeted therapies don't last as long. And so there's limitations in terms of their effectiveness for patients. It could be, 3 months, a year. But very often, the disease comes back and can overcome that resistance.
Drugs such as Gleevec and Herceptin have without question contributed to advances in the treatment of certain leukemias and breast cancers. But for almost all of the other cancers, the results have been disappointing.
In principle and logically, targeted therapy is much more promising. The unfortunate outcome, however, is that targeted therapy often works brilliantly, but after 6 or 7 or 8 months, the cancer cells figure out a new way to start proliferating, and these newly formed cancer cells are no longer affected by the initially introduced drug.
It means that we would become caught up in a never-ending chain of events without ever really arriving at a cure. That, I think, is one of the limitations of targeted therapies.
Why is it taking so long for the genetic revolution to come up with effective treatments? It is now estimated that over 2,000 genes might be involved in various cancers, and that the mutation rate could be 1,000 times higher depending on the tumor. And the further we probe, the more complicated it gets.
the major challenge that we have is to understanding what the data means. I was part of the Human Genome Project during the 1990s, and we sequenced that whole genome. It took 10 years, and we still don't understand most of the genes and the proteins and what the genomes do. So we still, our ability to do an interpretation of one genome, a whole community of scientists across the world is still challenged. It's how difficult it is.
The information, the technology for analyzing cancer cells is now so powerful that we are being inundated, we are being flooded with large amounts of information that vastly exceed our capabilities of digesting the information and understanding its implications. Clearly, without understanding what makes cancer cells grow abnormally, our hands are tied in terms of being able to create new kinds of therapies.
There are people who cynically would say, if you have a hammer, every problem is a nail. Cancer genes are now the nails. Because we have molecular genetic tools, we can go and hammer on cancer genes. So the question of, is this the best way to study cancer? Was it the best way? It was, in a certain sense, the best way given the tools that people had. Was it the solution to the problem of cancer?
In the early 1990s, patient advocacy groups were formed in protest against this fixation on genetics. They criticized its lack of therapeutic results. The organization Breast Cancer Action was founded in San Francisco in order to get cancer research out of its rut by challenging, first of all, its dogmatic focus on genetics. Yes, inherited gene mutations may increase the risk of cancer, but only in 5 to 10% of the cases.
When I was diagnosed, that there was a way in which the doctor just wanted to take what he had in front of him. That's to say, you know, a 36-year-old person with this stage breast cancer, and therefore they need this treatment, and throw me into the numbers.
I even had a really smart doctor say, well, you don't have a family history. And they said, you can't have breast cancer. And I, oh, okay. And I nodded along, but I did have breast cancer, and I was, you know, had done all those things you're supposed to do. And I felt like it was a revolution for me to find out the things I found out.
Inheriting a gene does not mean that you will get breast cancer. And we really do have to look at the inherited gene and environment interactions and why for some people it leads to cancer and for some people it doesn't.
But I think in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been so much concentration on genetics. And I see it in other diseases where they've accounted for the incidence of these various diseases because of genes that they've identified that people have in common. I don't know how that affects breast cancer, but I know that in general that this investment that genetics explains everything has kind of put things off track.
Could the scientific community have been on the wrong track for the last 30 years? Have we in fact come to a dead end?
By looking at these details, it looks as if we lost the forest for the trees, as Americans would say. And the holistic view became less prominent.
Back in the 1970s, research by American biologist Mina Bissell tended to prove that cancer arises from an interaction between certain cells and their environment. She was one of the first scientists to challenge the genetic theory of cancer.
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that, again, context or microenvironment. And in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that, in combination with the oncogene, could make a tumor.
But at the time, the budding sphere of genetics was monopolizing all of the attention, and Mina Bissell's work was virtually ignored.
People people say Mina is a pioneer. They say she's a visionary. Some people say. Some people think I'm crazy still. But no, I didn't think as a... I never thought. I just was curious. We published the papers in very many good journals, and the reactions basically were disbelief, or nobody paid attention. People would not quote them. They would not say this. It's only in the last 10 years or so that a lot of very well-known people are aware of the work, and they quote it, and they also say it's pretty obvious.
In order to understand cancer, do we need to change our focus? Should we examine cells in interaction with their environment? Consider how they breathe, eat, and develop? Observe them like we would observe an animal or a plant living within an ecosystem.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources, and we'll study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared, or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different verses of the Holy Quran that are related to the concept of humanity in the Holy Quran. And in the previous episode, we ended up talking about intellect as one very important aspect and dimension of the soul according to the verses and teachings of the Holy Quran. And then we ended up talking about different ahadith narrations from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam that interpret and explain the intellect. And so far we have read two hadith, and the last one we couldn't finish, the one from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam in the previous episode, that basically was talking, the hadith was talking about how divine prophets, actually they have the most perfect intellect. And this intellect is different than like the scientific intellect in the sense that nowadays we understand, because this scientific intellect is based on how to dominate over nature, how to make use of nature towards the sometimes different ends, like sometimes bad and evil goals, sometimes good goals. But that intellect is different. The intellect that we talk about that is in the Holy Quran is the ma'rifah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ma'rifah of the origin and the return, al-mabda'u wal-mahad. A person who exactly knows what he's doing in this planet, That scientific intellect does not tell you about al-mabda wa al-maut, does not tell you about the origin, does not tell you about the return. Yes, there are conjectures, but at the end of the day, it's not experimental knowledge. Nobody can have experimental knowledge of the start of the creation or the end of creation. And or the end of, they don't call it creation even because they don't believe in, but it, whatever that is the case, they don't know what will going to happen to it. And yet, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, they only follow the conjectures that they have. Anyways, so the Imam said, narrated from the Prophet ﷺ, that the Prophet said, "Inna ma'ashar al-anbiya, we, the group of the prophets, umirna, we have been commanded, we have been ordered by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, an nukallima an-nas ala qadr uqulihim, to talk to people only to the level or to the capacity that they have in terms of rationality and reason." So this is very important when it comes to different teachings of the religion, because the content in the Quran and Hadith, there are different levels of understanding it. Sometimes some people, because they have just superficial level of understanding or surface level, let's say, surface level understanding of the ideology of the religion, they don't dig deeper, they don't know the secrets lying deep within, underneath those shell of the religion, that shell of the religion. They think that that is it, like religion has only this part. But no, we have different levels of faith. We talked about different levels of faith in one episode. And like the way we have different levels of understanding the verses of the Holy Quran. And the secret to build a correct and long-lasting relationship with the Holy Quran is to open your heart for different. And when we say different, it doesn't mean contrasting. No, different means all the same things, but in different layers. Allama Tabatabai explains this in the beginning of his Tafsir al-Mizan, and inshallah, in some episode, we should talk about that as well. We will have a break, and we come back to continue our discussion and going through some of other ahadith about the intellect.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the first segment, we finished one hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now we shall go on to the next group of ahadith that explain one beautiful line from the Holy Quran. Now, this beautiful verse of the Holy Quran is this: "Inna sharra ad-dawab 'inda Allah as-summul bukm alladhina la ya'qilun." We had this in one episode, that like the way intellect is the best of the best in the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ma khalaq Allah afdal min al-aql, as we have in some hadith, or ma qassam Allah bayna ibadihi shay'an afdal min al-aql. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not distributed, has not given anything to anyone better than intellect. And we have the opposite. Divorced in the eyes of Allah, divorced in the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, are the deaf and dumb, those who don't think. Now, when you hear deaf and dumb, it doesn't mean like the physical problem, disabilities that people have. No, no. فَإِنَّهَا لَا تَعْمَ الْأَبْصَارِ. Quran explains in another verse that this is not about the disability of the physical eye. No. وَلَكَنْ تَعْمَ الْقُلُوبُ الَّتِي فِي الصَّدُورِ. It's about the disability of a person or blindness of the heart. We have explained this in several episodes. So Quran says الشر الدواب, the worst kind of beast, doesn't even call it human. Dawab means a beast, like just walking animal. In the eyes of Allah are those who don't use their intellect. How? frightening this is. And we have a hadith in that line, in Alal al-Shtarab by Sheikh al-Saduq, alayhi al-Rahma, by his chain of transmitters, he narrates from Imam al-Sadiq, alayhi al-Salam, مَا خَلَقَ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلْ شَيْئًا أَبْغَضْ إِلَيْهِ مِنَ الْحُمْقِ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has not created anything أَبْغَضْ إِلَيْهِ that he doesn't like, that he hates, even you can use that بغض because he has that meaning, then stupidity, foolishness. And this foolishness is not, like as they said, mental disability, because there is one beautiful hadith from the Prophet ﷺ that he was walking, I think we should talk about it in the next episode because we cannot cover it, give it its due right in this episode. That the Prophet was walking among a group of his companions, and they walked past a person who had this mental disability, and people had gathered around him, and the Prophet asked, "What's wrong? What's going on?" And the disciples said, "Well, there's a majnoon, there's an insane person here, there's a crazy person here." And the Prophet looked at the person and said, "No, he's not crazy. He has innama huwa al-musab. He has some problem. It's something out of his control. This has happened to him. Something has afflicted him, and he has this problem. This is a mental disability that he has, and we should help him something to this line. Innama huwa al-musab. Al-majnun aqqa al-majnun. The true crazy person is a person man athara dunyahu ala al-akhara. The person who sells his akhara in return for dunya, who destroys eternity for a temporary reward. That is the true." And there are different other versions of this hadith. Inshallah, in the next episode, we go through the hadith, which is very beautiful. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story today. Our story entitled The Stranger. Tired and exhausted with the water skin on her back, she was gasping and going towards her house where innocent children, their eyes fixed at the door, were eagerly waiting for the arrival of their mother. On her way, an unknown man approached her. He took the water skin from her and placed it on his back. The door opened and the children saw their mother entering the house with a stranger. He placed the water skin on the ground and said, "Well, it seems you don't have anyone to fetch water for you. How come you are so far alone?" "My husband was a soldier. Ali sent him to the frontier where he was killed. Now I'm alone with these small children." The stranger said no more. Bowing down his head, he went away. But the thought of the helpless widow and orphans remained in his mind. he could hardly sleep in the night. Early in the morning, he picked up a basket, put some meat, flour, and dates in it, went straight to her house and knocked at the door. "Who are you?" "I'm the man who brought you water yesterday. Now I have brought you some food for the children. May God bless you and judge between us and Eli." She opened the door. Entering the house, he said, "I wish to do some good acts. Either let me knead the flour and bake the bread, or allow me to look after the children." "Very well, but I can do the job of kneading and cooking better than you. You take care of the children till I finish cooking." She went to knead the flour. Immediately he grilled some meat, which he had brought, and fed the children, saying to each child while putting morsel in his mouth, "My son, forgive Eli if he has failed in his duty towards you." The flour got ready. She called, "Gentlemen, put fire in the oven." He went and put fire in the oven. When flames rose up, he brought his face near the fire and said, "Taste the heat of the fire. It is the punishment for those who fail in their duty towards orphans and widows." By chance, a woman from the neighboring house came in, recognizing the stranger. She cried, "Wow, don't you recognize the man who is helping you? He is Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib." The widow came forward and shamefacedly cried, "Curse and shame to me, I beg your pardon. No, I beg your pardon, for I failed in my duty towards you," the stranger said.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from iVerb English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to take some moral lessons out of them in order to talk more about them and explain about them. So that we as Muslims would take these lessons in our ordinary lives and become higher in and reach higher levels of spirituality and religion, inshallah. Well, the beautiful story we just listened to is about the care and attention that Imam Ali alayhi salam paid for the orphans and fatherless children. Well, a number of traditions available to us describe how Imam Ali alayhi salam ensured orphan children were taken care of, particularly during the period of his caliphate. These include narrations of Imam Ali alayhi salam visiting their homes under the cover of evenings to feed and cater their needs. One such narration tells us of a time when honey and figs were brought to Imam Ali alayhi salam from Hamadan and Helwan, a delicacy presented to him as the Khalifa of the time. Imam Ali alayhi salam's first response was to order the authorities of all tribes to bring along the orphans of the city. The narration tells us that he seated them above the leather containers of honey to eat from it. When questioned, he responded, "I am the father to the orphans. Indeed, I had them eat honey as their father." Imam Ali's insistence on prioritizing the orphan children when offered a delicacy teaches us all to present the very best we have to them. Imam Ali alayhi salam did not wait until his close family and friends had their turn before providing the children with the leftovers. Nor did he consider the delicacies a non-essential that the orphan children did not need. The lesson here extends beyond sustenance and clothing to include all aspects in life. If you think your children deserve the best in-class education and access to opportunities, so do orphan children. Okay, now let's go for a short break and we will be back very soon.
Thank you. lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. Well, another point is that not only did Imam Ali alayhi salam make sure that orphans were fed and clothed well, but he went out of his way to play with them. One narration describes how Imam Ali alayhi salam visited the home of a widow and her orphans with a bag full of ingredients and prepared a meal for them. When the children finished eating, Imam Ali alayhi salam began to hop around the room by mimicking a lamb and bleating and making them laugh. Qanbar, Imam Ali's helper, who had accompanied him, asked him later, "You're carrying the food on the back was for earning rewards, but I did not know the reason for your hopping around the room and begging." To which Imam Ali alayhi salam responded, "I like to leave them while they were laughing, and I found no other way for making them laugh than how I did." This teaches us the importance of play in every child's life, including orphan children. Just as Imam Ali alayhi salam did not want to leave the orphans with full bellies only, but with smiles on their faces, so too should we strive to care for the orphan children of our times beyond merely satisfying their need for food and shelter. We can learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam to leave the care of orphan children and the legacy we leave behind in this life, whether it is through including them in our will to, through passing on this sense of responsibility to the next generation, and through ensuring we care for orphan children during our lifetime, we can strive to respond to the call for duty that our beloved Imam Ali alayhi salam left for us. Okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah tatma'innul qulub.
A window to Palestine.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine. Born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora, Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Y será por siempre Palestina. Hola, amigos y amigas de todo el mundo. Marhaba.
Hello, friends from all over the world. Marhaba. Welcome to this new edition of A Window to Palestine. More than half of Gaza's population is at risk of dying from hunger today, the UN has warned. But we know that this did not start on October the 7th.
We need more help, as has already been said. We are seeing that we may be on the brink of famine in this region. They need supply. They need medical supplies. But the first thing they ask for is food and water. They don't have the most basic things.